Welcome to Rat Pack Roulette, the show where I sit down with interesting and inspirational people to share their story over ration packs from all over the world. My guest today is veteran, adventurer, athlete and fundraiser Carl Hynett. His remarkable story is not for the faint-hearted. In 2005, at the age of 18, he suffered 37% burns after his vehicle was petrol bombed on patrol in Basra, Iraq. Following his horrific incident, he went on to run in over 170 marathons, is an Invictus Games silver medalist, attempted to climb Everest, and recently trekked over 500 kilometres into the Arctic Circle as part of a Channel 4 documentary. Thank you for joining us today, Carl.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Where did life start for you? Where were you born? What did school look like?
I grew up on a council estate, didn't do too great at school, and it was almost like the military was my only option, as it seemed. You know, there weren't any real good jobs for me available. So I joined the Staffordshire Regiment, and turned out I absolutely loved it. The area that I grew up in, Tipton, small council estate in the West Midlands, the staffs were the point of call. My grandmother served, so she always told tales of her time in the military. You know, she did Germany. It was just after World War II, so national service had ended before she joined. But the adventures that she had and the friendships she made, she was still talking to them while I was growing up. So it was always in the back of my mind, the military, but being an ignorant young teenager, I didn't really give it too much thought until I'd left school, realised I had nothing to follow with, and then that's when I was like, maybe I need to sort myself out, and then the military just felt like the right thing to do.
It's the golden card for the army recruiting, isn't it?
It is,
scenario. That
got nowhere else to go, come and join the military.
What did your family think to the decision?
It was a mixture, really. There was some support, some sort of doubts. My nan was over the moon and she was my main support. But the rest of the family, there was like, yeah, we'll support, but, you know, sort of like half expecting me to, you know, give up at some point. When I joined, it actually turned out to be this amazing, great adventure.
Were you very aware of what things were looking like operationally at that point?
Yeah, so I remember going into the recruitment office again with my nan, and one of the first things the recruitment sergeant was saying was that, you know, Iraq's bubbling up, you know, it's you will go. There's no ifs or buts about it, you will go to Iraq. Which worried my nan a little bit, but she realised, you know, that things could happen given her time in the military. And it was just something that I accepted. If anything, it was more of an encouragement knowing that you're joining to go and do something.
So where was phase one?
So phase one was up in Catterick, and phase two was also in Catterick as well. So I spent 6 months there. I was still 17 at the time when I went and started training. And I had such a great time. I enjoyed myself so much that I actually managed to win best recruit.
Did you?
Without actually realising that I was, you know, showcasing those skills required. The challenge was something that brought out a character inside me that I never realised that I had.
What was it you enjoyed the most, would you say?
The sort of training that we were doing, it was fully embracing the outdoors. And that was something that I found that I really, really loved. You know, just being amongst forests, fields, even if it was running up and down a hill. That act of being outdoors, enjoying the fresh air and, you know, embracing the challenge. I just really enjoyed it. This is me. You know, 22 years, I'm in for the long haul.
Oh, got your first course for you here.
Here you go. French, okay.
There's a smiling face on that.
Well, that's bit of morale in the field, isn't it? Yeah. Maybe is it a pâté of some sort?
It's chicken liver pâté.
Chicken liver pâté. I mean, I've got to be honest, it looks like cat food.
It looks like rubber, doesn't it? The smell.
Yeah.
It's strong.
I've got to admit, when I had pâté in ration packs before, it was always the last thing that I'd eat.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a bit sausagey.
I mean, initially, it's quite repulsive. The taste grows on you a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to have another bit just for confirmation. It does smell a bit like cat food, like you're saying.
Yeah.
I think the smiling lady in the front is more morale than the food itself.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't go to that first. If I was absolutely starving, I think I might.
Yeah.
But it's not bad.
Individually, what would you say out of 10 this is?
I'd go with maybe 4, maybe 4.5.
I agree with you there. It's, yeah. you just got to get it down, you haven't you? It's not great.
Yeah.
So you deployed to Iraq on Telek. How did your family take it the day you left? What do you remember?
It was a bit of a tough one. I remember being quite excited to go, you know, and put my skills to practice, go and help people, you know. Iraq wasn't really receiving many casualties at the time in the lead up to me going. Mm. So, like, they weren't exposed too much to, you know, the media putting a spin on, you know, soldiers dying or getting wounded. As I left, they were upset because I was going, but that was probably the main reason they was getting upset, because I'd be gone for 6 months and I'd just turned 18 years old. I'd never really left home before. Mm. So it was quite a shock to them. But they accepted that, you know, I was doing well for myself. This is what I wanted to do. And they eventually gave me their blessing.
You land in Iraq. Mm-hmm. What was your, what things do you remember?
Just the heat was, you know, I've not really well travelled or anything at this point, but like that oppressive heat, and it was only April sort of time. It was hotter than anything I'd ever felt. And then realising that we'd had to work and operate in this heat with body armour, helmets, backpacks, you know, it was daunting.
So before your incident, which that effectively really did change your life massively, yeah. How long were you on operations before that occurred?
Unfortunately, I'd nearly finished my 6 month tour.
Oh no.
So it was about 3 weeks or so before we were due to end and come back home. It just sort of came out of nowhere, really. Like we woke up one day, we was on QRF, you know, Quick Reaction Force. And then we just heard that there was an incident going down in the city outside this police station that always was a bit dodgy.
Yeah.
But it just turned out that two SF guys had got taken sort of captive and we were going to support, you know, in our warriors. It was almost like a huge scene had already established itself because there's so many people on the ground, so many sort of locals who were forming a crowd. We were sort of like trying to draw the crowd away, which we were quite successful with because the warriors, these massive 26-ton vehicles, they just became a target, really. But unfortunately, it just escalated to a point where I ended up getting petrol bombed.
And prior to that, on that build-up, did you feel uneasy or did you feel like it was coming?
I mean, you could sense the change in the environment, but if anything, I became more stubborn, as 18-year-olds do, and I firmly believe that I was invincible. I was, you know, best recruit in the military. I was out on operations. I thought stupidly that I was untouchable, and that very, very quickly came to an end when I got petrol bombed.
I think as 18-year-old soldiers, particularly in the military, you do think you're invincible.
Yeah.
You do think it's not going to happen to you. You do think you'll be fine.
Yeah.
You think you're bulletproof.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through then, effectively, step by step, what happened in the minutes leading up to it and then straight after?
The crowd was sort of like getting more and more confident. There were reports of, like, you know, gunshots and everything. But, like, me sitting in my turret, you know, I felt even safer because I'm encased in, you know, inches thick of armour that's impenetrable to, like, bullets and everything like that. But unfortunately, our periscopes, how they got damaged, I have no idea. But the only way we could see out, really, was popping our heads out. And the layout of the warrior is the commander who's sitting next to me in the turret needs to give directions to the driver so they can operate and safely move the vehicle around, because their line of sight is very sort of blinkered. You know, the last thing you want to do is accidentally run someone over.
Yeah.
The hatches were open. We were popping our heads out just to make sure that we were, you know, in the clear to move around, because it was a shifting environment, you know, as things were going on at the prison, the crowds advancing, we're moving around a little bit. It was out of nowhere, just a ball of flame really just came pouring down. For a split second, I smelt sort of like petrol first, you know, that really intense, familiar smell of petrol. And then like a second later, it was just ignited. It was such a unexpected shock that even on the day, you know, you'd see them throwing bricks and things like that, and you'd see little kids running around in and out of the crowd. And it's serious, but it's not that serious because, you know, there's children running around, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen? But unfortunately, that's why caught me so much off guard. Again, with that mentality of being untouchable, you sort of let my guard down just a little bit. Yeah. And that's where it came and bit me in the ass, really.
Petrol bomb goes in, explodes. What happens next?
The inside of a turret in the Warrior is very close. There's barely enough room for you and your commander sitting side by side. You can barely move. So when there's fire in there, there's nothing you can do. You're basically stuck fast, you know, burning alive. My brain switched off because any rational thoughts I couldn't even process because I was on fire, completely engulfed. Because it came through my side, my sergeant, he managed to jump out. It sort of like chased after him. He still got injured. You'll see the famous picture where there's the image of the guy jumping out of the Warrior on fire. So that was my sergeant. That was
really
in that picture. I'm still stuck inside on the side what's on fire. And for a good 20, 25 seconds, I was just completely consumed by panic. I had no idea what to do. All I needed to do was go up and get out. Yeah. But I couldn't even think of that. I couldn't breathe. I was screaming. You know, my arms were exposed, my hands were exposed. Luckily, I had body armour on, my helmet on, ear defenders. It was only when, like, the pain really started to settle in did I realise that, you know, if I don't do anything, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. Being completely honest, like, a thought did cross my mind, you know, like, everyone knows what fire injury does and it destroys lives, you know. Is it worth even trying? But, like, it was so painful that I couldn't sit there and, you know, allow fate to take its course. I managed to sort of, like, grip onto, like, the burning rim of the Warrior. It's why my hands were so badly damaged. And sort of, like, heave myself up. And as I tried to push myself up, my headset, you know, for us to talk to each other, was still attached. So as I pushed myself up, it pulled me back down, and I was devastated at that point. Pushed myself up again, and whether the cable snapped or melted, I pushed myself so far forward that I ended up sort of like catapulting off the top of the Warrior, and I just came to a hard stop on the floor, and that was it then. I couldn't do anything to save myself then. It was almost like I used every bit of energy just to get out. Luckily though, my mates were there. They had fire extinguisher ready, and they came round, put me out and scooped me up. I had water poured all over me, because I later found out that was because, you know, you take meat out of a pan, it's still cooking for a little while. So like essentially my body was still cooking. So like they brought my core temperature down and then they bandaged me up, and then I waited for a helicopter to come and Kazivac me away.
It's an incredible scenario. I think it's quite unique, isn't it? Well, when we think of operations, we do think of soldiers being blown up, and we think of definitely soldiers being shot. But it's not often we think of soldiers being effectively burnt alive.
Yeah.
Do you know of any other scenarios like that?
There is a few guys who have, you know, unfortunately suffered burn injuries. It is only because of, you know, the advancement in medical science that, like, people with our sort of injuries could survive more. The people who came and picked me up in the helicopter and the people who treated me in the back of the ambulance, they were all over it. They were, luckily, the care I had, it saved my life.
Do you ever knew who threw the petrol bomb? Did the crowd disperse in fear of what's going on? What were the atmospherics like at that point?
I never knew who threw that petrol bomb. And I've thought about that before, and now I have no grudges or ill feelings towards that person because, I mean, stripping it right back, they tried to kill me.
Yeah.
But how I look at my life now, like I'm in such a good place. I can't feel anything but happy that I survived and the turning that my life took because of it. I could not do anything to save myself, even if I was dragged away, you know, I couldn't have done anything to help myself.
You were put into a coma, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember anything leading up to that?
So I remember having morphine injected into my leg. My clothes were cut away. I remember looking at my hands, you know, that it was almost like burnt candle wax all over my hands. It was a weird feeling, but the pain becomes so intense then that time seemed to slow a little bit. But I think it was about 15 minutes or so before the helicopter came. I remember the rotor blade still going, and it sort of ripped off all the bandages that I had. So I remember the sort of like stinging pain of, like, you know, dust going into my wounds, just drifting in and out of consciousness. But I remember that helicopter ride taking seconds, and then was touching down again. And I remember my stretcher bouncing around, and then I was put onto a table, clearly in an operating theatre. And then I just had a mask put over my face. I felt a sharp pinch going to my foot, where they put a needle into my foot, because there was nowhere to put a drip in my arms or my hands. That was it then. Everything went dark. And then I woke up 10 days later, back in Birmingham.
I find it quite incredible that you do remember so much up to that point, because normally in these traumatic scenarios, the brain effectively deletes memories. Do you still keep in contact with the lads that were in the Warrior with you that day?
So my sergeant, still keep in touch with him. He's still serving. Every now and again, we still keep in touch with, the wider regiment as well. I remember in the first few weeks of waking up, the tour had finished, and all of them from my platoon came and visited, like, very much so breaking the, two-visitor rule, because there was about 30 guys in there. They always kept in touch. But my sergeant, George Long, he suffered 4% burns. A percent is measured by the palm of your hand, so that's 1%. He was still active that day. He reclaimed the Warrior, and nothing short of heroic, you know, his actions.
Were you fully aware of the impact and the implications of what you're about to...
As I was injured, I remember as I was being carried away, I was just like, why is it got to be burns? You know, why couldn't I have something like a gunshot, or, you know, I'd, you know, lose a limb? That's the thoughts that were going through my head, because I knew that burn injuries, the recovery is forever, you know, it never stops.
You wake up in Selyhock Hospital in Birmingham, quite close to home. Can you recall that moment?
I recall it was like a staged awakening. So I remember, you know, coming to and, you know, drifting in and out. And I remember, you know, various faces, you know, my family about. I couldn't speak. I mean, it was because I had a breathing tube in. It was a little bit nerve-wracking because, like, did I really escape? Or, you know, am I bound and gagged somewhere? You know, all sorts of horrible sort of things going through my head. But then, like, I'd hear the voices of, you know, family, the smell of, like, cleaning fluids, you know. It felt very sterile where I was, like, rationally and being realistic. My brain was trying to work out that, you know, I can't be in Iraq anymore because, like, things are just too clean. And when I managed to sort of, like, start seeing people properly, it was fine then. I was like, right, we're here, let's crack on.
Was there a sense of relief that you were, like, you were home?
Yeah. I'd see my family, I'd see my nan, you know. It was all very reassuring that I was back home safe, so I could, you know, start now working to get better. Burns, injuries, as with all injuries, they are lifelong, but, you know, it doesn't stop my injury now. 37% of my body was injured. I have to have surgery for the rest of my life, you know, opening up scar tissues, because as wounds heal, as scars form, they sort of constrict and tighten. So, like, it's almost like a constant battle to try and have a surgical procedure, open them up again, but in turn you're causing another scar. You know, it's like an endless sort of, like, cycle of, like, trying to keep mobility.
Do you worry, get nervous about these operations, or are you quite cool and calm about it now?
Honestly, like, but my recovery process in, you know, Selyhock, and then, you know, transition to Queen Elizabeth Hospital, the care that they gave me, you know, it was almost like a second home being there. I know I'm in very good hands, so I never have any worries going into hospital.
From the American ration pack, meatballs in marinara sauce.
The Americans look after their soldiers.
They do. So we had the pizza recently and it wasn't great, but it's pizza in a ration pack.
Ready?
Yeah. Oh. They're very small meatballs.
They are.
I'm just going to go for a whole meatball.
Straight in.
It's pretty good.
I'd eat that.
It's very tangy, which I was expecting to be quite bland.
A bit of pasta in there would have
It's quite
gone
saucy.
A long way. but taste-wise, you know.
Scoop it up with biscuit browns.
Mm. Very happy with this. I'd eat this at home.
It's got a lot of flavour for a ration pack.
Yeah.
That's really good. I'll let you score it.
8. 8 out of 10.
Great, 8 out of 10. Well done, the Americans, as always, coming through with the ration packs.
You know your food.
Yeah. What's the transition out of the army look like for you at this point?
I sort of tried to convince myself that I could go back to where I was doing. But as sort of time wore on, I realised there was no going back because my injuries, you know, they were just too severe. And if anything, I would have hated to have been sort of like a hindrance to my friends. In those very early days, I sort of like acknowledged that the military, unfortunately, was going to be over for me. And it was a very bitter pill to swallow because it's almost like I invested everything of myself into it. You know, I finally found something that I loved doing, that I was actually good at. But now it's sort of been taken away from me, like very, very early on in my career.
Did you find there was an impact mentally after leaving and arriving at Civvy Street?
It was quite hard to wrap my head around. I'm 18 years old. I've got no job now. I'm full on disabled. And like what little looks I had are gone. You know, it was the important things that, you know, at the time of an 18-year-old that seem important, you know, that are the world to you, we're all, you know, thrown up in the air. And I almost became a recluse. Screw it. I'm going to lock myself away and just sort of like, just try and survive.
What changed? Because obviously that wasn't the case. And we'll move on to many of the incredible things you've done.
Yeah.
What changed?
Again, it was my nan. She sort of saved me, really. She put the right sort of mindset back into my everyday life. Having served herself, she knew that I needed to fill my time with something that I could really throw myself into. All that was just the simple art, I suppose, of going out for a run. I found it really difficult after injury, but I really enjoyed it before. So when I first started trying to get out, all my muscle had wasted away and everything. I struggled to walk. I went down to about 8 stone after I got injured. I started just clocking up miles by just going for a walk and going for a run. And that's how I really, really fell in love with running. And that was sort of my therapy, really. That's what dragged me out of the hole that I found myself falling into.
And how does just going out for a run turn into 170 plus marathons?
It became such an important part of my life that it was like every day I'd go out for a run and I was just really, really enjoying that high that runners get. It weren't like an overnight sort of thing, you know, that all of a sudden you become like amazing at running. You know, it took days and weeks and months and years. And this was over a 5-year period where I was in and out of hospital having surgery. I felt like I really wanted to give something back. So 2011 came and 2012, I planned to run 100 marathons in those 2 years. And I found that these were all over the world. So I thought, you know, I'm going to go explore, live life, and at the same time fundraise by running lots of marathons.
Obviously, all over the world, loads of different climates and terrain. What was the hardest?
There's one at the geographic North Pole where you're literally on floating, frozen sea ice. Antarctica, out in the Amazon jungle. Project Fire and Ice is definitely up there, out in the Arctic. The jungle was horrendous because everything wants to bite you or sting you or, you know, slow you down. One much closer to home, up in the Lake District, was very, very difficult.
Really?
Yeah. It was a 105 miles around the Lake District.
Okay.
It's like a notoriously hard event, which I've tried twice before and failed, but then went back for the third time last year and managed to finally finish it. I've been very lucky to see places that I would never have seen otherwise because they just take you off the beaten path.
How did you end up at Invictus Games?
2018, I signed myself up, went to all the training camps. I was starting to become quite comfortable with long distance running, with marathons. But the longest race in Invictus is 1,500 metres. That is much harder than I realised.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You have to run so fast, but like it's not just a sprint. I found it really difficult.
And you walked away with a silver medal?
surprised myself with that. And you know, my wife was there, my young son was there, and so like they watched me as I raced. And medal or not, it was all about the experience of being there. And you know, the medal was a bonus.
And then you decided you wanted to take on Mount Everest, but unfortunately you didn't make it. Can you explain what happened?
It started back in 2011. A charity, Walking with the Wounded, they had taken a group of wounded soldiers and they trekked to the North Pole. And they was like, our next challenge is Everest. And I thought, why not? You know, I'm alive, you know, I'm going to live my life now. And, you know, challenges just make it that more interesting. It was, however, during the 2 years that I was running 100 marathons. I did all the application and they had a number of events that, you know, training events and selection events that you needed to do. Climbing around Wales, climbing in the Alps, and then doing a practice run in the Himalayas. That practice run, we was away for 8 weeks and we climbed the eighth highest mountain in the world called Manaslu. We're almost sort of like sending a message to the wounded community that you can do stuff. Yeah. Unfortunately, when Everest came around in 2012, the season just wasn't in our favour. It was too warm, there was too many avalanches, and the expedition manager didn't want to risk it, and I don't blame him. Yeah. And our attempt was cancelled.
How did that feel, that having that taken away from you, and what did you learn from it?
I mean, we got up to the Lhotse face and everything, you know, just shy of 7,000 metres. You know, the summit was sort of in our grasp, really. Yeah. It did almost become sort of like, you know, summit fever, tunnel vision, I've got to get to the top because that might answer all the questions I'm seeking. When it was taken away from us, it sort of reminded me a little bit of being in the military. Things can change. Not everything's always in your control. And Everest really sort of like the summit, the end point, that's not always the answer to everything. It's almost like a bit cliche, but it's like the journey.
Of course, yeah.
At the end of the day, life's not, you know, one goal, is it? You have to live. You have to sort of like have a great time.
Do you have any desire to give it another go? Or do you feel that, obviously, because the elements dictate much of it, that actually it might not be worth it?
The cold, I really suffer, partly because I can't feel the cold until it's too late. And altitude is my worst nightmare. It's like the worst hangover I've ever had.
Really?
And then doing exercise on top of that, it's my stomach is all over the place. I've got worst headaches ever. It was just really difficult. So if I had to have the option of doing it again, I'd never say never, but like it wouldn't be my first point of call.
I mean, you're still to be commended for what you achieved, getting as far as you did, because that's still incredible, I think.
I'm happy with that, yeah.
What have we got next?
So we've got hot chocolate from the British ration pack.
High expectations.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure you've had a few of these in your time.
Yeah. Cheers.
Thank you.
It's not bad.
It's exactly how I remember it.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed at all in at least 20 years.
It does feel like maybe the whole sachet might need to go in one cup.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Let's talk about Project Fire and Ice, which by the time this goes out, it will be on Channel 4. It sounds incredible, so can you elaborate for us?
Project Fire and Ice started because I wanted to sort of do a challenge, a charity event, because it was the 20-year anniversary of being injured. I approached a good friend of mine, Richard French, who works for SAFA. I'm looking for an event to do. And then a few days later, he came back with this, a 500-kilometre trek in the Arctic. I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Agreed to it before fully understanding what was involved.
Who are you doing it with?
Myself, then Brian Wood, the Military Cross winner. He knew Foxy, who agreed to come along as well. And because of Foxy, he knew Aldo. So before we knew it, we had this, you know, solid four-man team. They seemed to sort of like love the premise of the idea, you know, doing a really challenging event, doing it for mental health, doing it for SAFA, trying to raise money in the profile around sort of mental health in veterans and the wider community as well.
And the journey itself, what was that like for you and the rest of the lads?
It was not easy at all. We had 10 days, you know, it was sort of like an organised race. Mm. Very few people taking part, and we were the only team. To start off with, it was never about, like, you know, doing it fast, you know. It was more about sort of getting stuck in, embracing the sort of challenge, talking to each other as well about our struggles, because all four of us have gone through it, and just sort of like enjoying the environment that we were in. And if it helps, you know, just even one person sort of like speak up, get help, you know, then we've done a good job. Hopefully people can resonate with one, if not more, of our, or all of our experiences.
That'll be available to watch on Channel 4, right?
Yeah, Channel 4, be available on Catch Up. And the title is Arctic Adventure, Ultimate Survival.
What's your next challenge?
Next one is a bit closer to home, but a mountain that I'm pretty sure all military members know, Pennyfan. This coming Easter, the 3rd to the 5th, I'm going to be making 22 continuous summit attempts of Pennyfan, all in one go, because unfortunately, in the UK alone, it's 22 people who commit suicide every single day. That is an astonishing number, but the military, unfortunately, do encompass some of that number. So this challenge is to sort of highlight the struggles of mental health, to try and get more awareness around suicide prevention. If people want to join in and do a hill rep or two with me, they're more than welcome to come and join. If you want to get involved, you can come and join me. You can check out my website at karlheinert.co.uk, or just check out my socials on Instagram.
French chocolate cream dessert.
Interesting.
I'm expecting good things.
Uh-huh. I mean, the fact that it's in a tin, I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Oh, it's liquid. Okay, yeah, of course, yeah. Chocolate cream dessert. Yeah. So this should be okay, right?
It's hard to get chocolate wrong, isn't it?
It smells like ration chocolate.
Ah. Okay. I mean,
not disgusting?
No. I mean, it feels like it should be poured over something.
Well, this is exactly like the sauce you get in the British one, right? With the cake. So, go on, out of 10, the French chocolate sauce, effectively.
A bit controversial, but I'm going to go 6.
6? Yeah. That low?
Well, just because I'm not a massive fan of chocolate anyway, I think as desserts go, that could have been better.
I want to ask you one question at the end, and I think I know the answer. If you had the chance to go back in time and that day in Bazrad didn't have to occur and you didn't suffer the injuries you did, would you take that chance?
Knowing where I've got now, if I knew what was coming, I wouldn't change a thing. It changed my perspective, you know, sort of trying to enjoy what life has, you know, it, making your own opportunities and the people who are around you, you know, the relationships that you can have. It makes me really feel like life's worth living.
Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. BFBS, the Forces Station.